Our third case for argument today is Comrie against IPSCO. Mr. Mollica.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Mollica, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Comrie. First of all, I trust nobody had to root around in this case. We tried to provide the relevant documents. And in most ERISA cases, everyone essentially agrees on what the relevant plan documents are, and the question is how to apply them to the facts. But in this benefit claim, we have a document problem, and I would contend a benefit committee problem that they did not apply the proper documents and instead interpreted the documents in a way that is inconsistent both with how they appear in the administrative record and how they were presented to Mr. Comrie, the participant in this case.
Let me just ask you this. Do you dispute that the LTIP award or LTIP award or however we want to characterize it expressly provided that it would not be considered when calculating the supplemental executive retirement plan? I mean, what should we make of that information?
It does say that, Your Honor. And I don't think the Benefit Committee had that before them when they were deciding this. It probably would have informed their deliberations. I would say, Your Honor, that then what you'd have is an inconsistency. And the plan committee would be having the LTIP in front of it on one hand, and then it would have the 401k plan and the SPD on the other that indicate that an incentive pay award is calculated as compensation. So it would present a conflict problem. The fundamental place you start in this case is the SERP plan. The SERP plan in paragraph 1.09 tells us that compensation is determined as, quote, defined under the IPSCO, in this case 401k plan. The plan committee and then the district court believe that all that meant is that all they had to do was to look at the adoption agreement, which was the checkbox form that's in dispute in this case. And they stopped there. There are a couple problems with that, Your Honors. First of all, it disregards the importance of the summary plan description. The summary plan description stated, and this is the first document that John Comrie got when he went to the Human Resources Department, says that compensation means...
You refer to the summary plan description. I gather there is a dispute between the parties about whether this summary plan description applies to the SERP plan as opposed to the 401k plan. You believe that it applies to the SERP plan. What's the basis for that belief?
The belief is, Your Honor, that the SERP adopts the definition of...
SERP is not an English word.
Sorry, excuse me. I've been litigating this for 3 years, Your Honor, and bad habits.
All the more reason to get rid of, to clear one's head of cobwebs.
Okay. The SERP, Your Honor, adopts the definition of compensation defined under the 401k plan.
The SERP can adopt anything it wants.
Correct.
My question is, what makes you think that the summary plan description of the 401k plan is also the summary plan description of the SERP?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, in order to reach a definition of what compensation means, which is the central term we're talking about, we have to go to the 401k plan. And what the 401k plan is two documents.
But it doesn't make the summary plan description the description of a different plan. I can understand the argument that since the SERP points to the 401k plan, we might be able to use the summary plan description of the 401k plan as an interpretive tool. But it doesn't make the summary plan description of the 401k plan the summary description of the SERP.
The second argument, Your Honor, that we make is that when the summary plan description was given to Mr. Comrie and he was told he could rely on it to determine his retirement benefits, he stated in his original letter and every subsequent letter to the Benefits Committee that he was relying on the summary plan description definition of compensation. The Benefits Committee in neither letter ever told him otherwise.
I don't think you can make the summary plan description of Plan A the description of Plan B just by writing a letter saying, I'm going to rely on the description of Plan A as the description of Plan B, and not getting an answer back saying, you're nuts. right? It either is or isn't the summary plan description for the SERP.
I haven't yet
heard an argument that it is, right? You may have claims of we can use it for interpretive purposes, or the argument you're now making is your second argument. It sounds like some form of estoppel.
Well, in this case, Your Honor,
that doesn't apply under ERISA, we keep saying, right? But I don't see why it makes it the summary plan description. I'm particularly interested in this because, as you know, although the parties haven't talked about this very much, the Supreme Court heard oral argument back in November in a case called Cigna against Amara, which poses the question, what happens when the summary plan description conflicts with the underlying plan? We need to know whether we should wait for Amara, what weight Amara will have in this case, and so on. If you have any views on that, I'd appreciate them.
Yes, Your Honor. Cigna involved a class action where there were 18,000 participants, and there was a question about whether you would have to establish individualized reliance on the summary plan description, and the Second Circuit adopted the District of Connecticut's opinion that they didn't have to. So that is an issue that could have some effect on this case because it will tell us what weight a summary plan description ought to have in interpreting a plan. But in this case, we have evidence of actual reliance by the participant. So,
Wait a minute. I'm not sure I understand a claim of reliance here. Didn't Mr. Comrie resign first before he started seeking information about the meaning of the SERP?
No, Your Honor. He made a request for the 401k plan before the August 1st resignation letter, and he got the document he got was the summary plan description. That's the order it happened in.
Let me go back a little bit. Since the profit sharing bonus would be excluded from even the broadest possible definition of compensation under the 401k plan, right?
The profit-sharing bonus, yes.
Wouldn't it be meaningless to exclude it from the definition of earnings in the 401k plan? Or am I mixed up?
The profit-sharing plan was the smaller plan. I think they called it the February payment. And that would be excluded under Appendix A1 because it's a bonus. So that would not have been calculated in the SERP definition of compensation for Mr. Comrie. The benefits that we're seeking to have included in compensation are the other two.
I don't think bonus extends to what you're talking about.
Not in this case, Your Honor, because the plan drafters had two different terms that they used. They used incentive and they used bonus.
No, the plan drafters didn't do that, but whoever wrote the summary plan description of the 401k did.
Well, Your Honor, in the SERP...
Now, this distinction can't be found in the plan itself, can it?
Yes, it can, Your Honor. In the SERP...
Plan, why are you even bothering to mention the summary plan description?
It's an important part of the interpretation of the 401k definition of compensation. The reason I say that there is a distinction is that in the SERP, they use the term incentive pay in the definition of compensation. They say that we're going to carve out payments that were made prior to January 1st, 2005 of incentive pay or incentive, and then in the Appendix A1 they say we're excluding bonuses. They use two different terms in the SERP. That's why I think that you can distinguish one from the other, Your Honor.
It's certainly not an irrational interpretation.
Well, it is one that is against the terms of the plan, and it is certainly one that's against the terms of the SPD.
We're reviewing something that this committee has already passed on.
Your Honor, I accept for purposes of the argument that we have to defer to the Benefit Committee. If they applied the plan correctly, if they applied it against its terms.
They've applied it this way consistently for everybody else, isn't it, right?
It would have benefited. Everyone had their own appendix, so some executives were covered differently than others. The A1 people did not get bonus. Everybody else, the appendices are silent.
I'm I have a collateral question about the stock-based compensation awards. Were they discretionary awards, or were they entitlements?
You were entitled to a payment under the plans. I believe the amount you got may have been discretionary.
Well, doesn't that rather support the committee's view? If there's a provision in your client's contract that says something like, at the end of every year, right, Comrie is entitled to stock options, but how many stock options he gets is completely discretionary with other people in the company. That looks a lot like a bonus. If, on the other hand, the contract had said at the end of every year he's entitled to 10,000 stock options, that looks much more like an aspect of salary. And you say it's the former. He's entitled, but how many is discretionary?
That's right, Your Honor. But they've made a decision. Now these amounts are liquidated. There's no question about how much he was paid. It was on his W-2. What the benefit committee faced wasn't the question
bonuses. Once a bonus is awarded, we know exactly how much it was.
Well, the bonus in this case, though, wasn't on his W-2. But on the W-2, so there is a sense in which the plan drafters could have said these should be treated as bonuses. But that would force us to ignore the incentive pay language in the SERP and would force us to completely disregard the summary plan description that uses different language. Your Honors, I'm going to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Miyasi.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, William Miyasi for the appellees. If I may, to address the comment that you, Judge Roedner, made at the opening, if you root around in the record looking for something called the 401K SERP SPD.
I think that was the last case.
Sorry?
I think that was the last case.
And Mr. Malik has started off by expressing his pleasure that you wouldn't have to do that here. And in this case, there is no such document which the appellants base their principal argument on, which is...
Well, then we don't have to root around in the record for
precisely.
It.
Precisely. So I'll move on.
Doesn't the Supplemental Executive Retirement Plan rely on the 401K for a definition of earnings?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And if that's so, then shouldn't the plan also be able to rely on the 401K summary plan for a definition of earnings, since by law the summary plan description is a document with equal footing to that of the plan itself?
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I don't think the authorities would support that contention. The SERP is very clear in directing the benefit committee to the 401K plan document to determine the definition of compensation. It does not direct the committee or anyone else to the summary plan description for the 401K plan. And those two are very different documents. And to Judge Easterbrook's question, I don't think the resolution of this case need await the Supreme Court's decision in Cigna versus Amara. I don't think the issues here are overlap in any way whatsoever. Another comment that I'd like to add, since I picked it up on some of the colloquy back and forth a moment ago, it is not correct. It is not true. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Comrie was told by any authority at the company to rely upon
But it seems to me that he made it pretty clear, not pretty clear, but I think he made it clear to Mr. Rary, that he wanted the 401K plan. You know, he wanted the plan so that he could understand the definition of compensation, you know, in his pension. And at summary judgment, we have to take the facts as true. So shouldn't we assume that he relied on, you know, the provision of the 401K plan when he was calculating his benefits?
No, because those aren't the facts. I believe it was July 27th, 2007, Mr. Comrie sent an email to the Vice President for Human Resources and asked, without any explanation or prefatory reason, could you please send me the 401k plan? He referred to it by its official title, the Retirement Savings and Profit Sharing Plan. Comrie responds, you mean the 401k? He directs his assistant to send him the documents. She first sends him the SPD. She subsequently sends him the entire plan document. But at no point leading up to that request did Mr. Comrie, and there's no evidence in the record, that he said, the reason I want this is to determine my SERP, because he hadn't resigned yet, number one, and number two, he hadn't made a claim for a benefit under the SERP. So the chronology disproves the contention that there was any reliance there. And indeed, if there were reliance and he relied to his detriment, I think we would have seen, an estoppel claim.
So let's see. So, okay. So is it possible that if Mr. Comrie had gone to a court in 2002 to say that his service was not being credited as promised, that a court would have told him that his case wasn't right?
No.
Right? As, you know, he hadn't been harmed yet.
No. Onto the counts two and three, no, Your Honor. I think the rule of accrual is very clear in this instance. He was allegedly made promises, A, we'll secure your benefit with a letter of credit under a Canadian chartered bank, and two, we will award you, or we will credit you one full year of service for each full year you work in the United States. He knew after the first year, by virtue of documents he received each year, that told him, here's your U.S. service credit, here's your Canadian service credit. So he was aware, and upon notification, he's aware that we allegedly repudiated this promise. It would be no different, if I could use an analogy, if the promise were, each year we will deposit $5,000 in a phantom account for you, and at your retirement, whenever that may be, you can collect that money. And in 2002, following my analogy, someone in the company says, Mr. Comrie, we've changed our mind. We aren't going to do that anymore. Well, he can't afford to wait until the statute of limitations expires to then claim breach. He can't await the harm. And I think the law in Illinois on that is very clear.
Well, are you arguing that Illinois doesn't recognize the doctrine of anticipatory repudiation?
No, I'm not. No. I think Illinois law does recognize anticipatory repudiation, but that is repudiating a future obligation. The obligations that are alleged here were occurring each year. Actually, the letter of credit occurred at the very outset, but then the award of service credit occurred each year, and Mr. Comrie was notified each year that he wasn't getting what he claims he should have gotten, and he acknowledges that in the record.
Okay, so you're arguing that Illinois recognizes the doctrine.
To my reading of Illinois law is they do recognize a doctrine of anticipatory repudiation.
I'm really interested because I haven't done enough research, but I think it's entirely unclear.
I'm happy if it is unclear, at least as far as it's alleged in this case, Judge, but I don't think it matters. Indeed, I don't think it matters to the degree that we believe primarily that the counts alleged in 2 and 3 are preempted under ERISA. And we made that argument to the trial court at the initial stages, and he rejected that based upon an argument that Canadian law, as opposed to any law of the 50 states or its territories, is not preempted by the statute.
Let me just, I don't know, something else that I think needs some more research, and that is if, in fact, Illinois and Canadian law conflict and, you know, whether ERISA preempts Illinois choice of law. I mean, ERISA is meant to preempt all state laws. We know that, right?
Yes.
But can it just obviously be said that it preempts foreign laws well? I don't know.
I won't sit here and tell you that the definition of the word state in ERISA is meaningless. The word is capitalized, and it means something in Section 514A. There's no dispute about that. But I'll answer the question two ways. One is, in order for the court to import Canadian law into these claims, the court first had to apply Illinois choice of law doctrine. That is part of the state law. It's the conclusion in our judgment and our contention is it's unavoidable that state law was applied in bringing the Canadian law into the questions posed, the claims posed.
That's preempted, right?
Correct. So, if you will, it begs the question, you can't get to Canadian law by virtue of applying any state law, choice of law doctrine. And thus, it's preempted on that basis alone. I could make, and you could consider, a larger policy argument that I know the court's very well aware of, given the Supreme Court pronouncements for 30-plus years, how exclusive federal jurisdiction is, et cetera, under ERISA. But I don't think you need to do that to conclude, as an alternative basis for affirmance, that counts 2 and 3 are preempted. The comment, if I revert back to count 1 for just a moment, I think the point's been well made and appreciated. The whole issue of the 401K and the 401K SPD is a red herring, a false protagonist. That's not what the subject of this lawsuit is about. It's about an SERP benefit, not a 401K benefit. There was no adverse reliance. Regardless, the committee exercised its authority in interpreting the definition, Appendix A1's exclusion of bonus, which is the appendix to the SERP that applied its discretion using a dictionary a definition of bonus as any compensation outside of base compensation. That comports, interestingly, with Mr. Comrie's expert actuary who testified in the case when asked whether he considered incentive compensation to be within the definition of bonus. He thought, yes, that it did. It also comports with the way Mr. Comrie characterized that portion of his income in documents submitted for loans, et cetera. There is no arbitrary and capricious, put it this way, a committee can't act arbitrarily or capriciously by applying the terms of the benefit plan. And that's precisely what they did in this case. The final count, if I'll use my last moments to address, is count 4, an interesting claim, certainly in my career, for Canadian-style severance benefits. The court properly applied Illinois law to conclude that, based upon significant context, that Canadian law did not govern the disposition of count 4. Illinois doesn't recognize any such concept as apparently they do in Canada, and thus the claim was dismissed. But even if you consider the Canadian authorities that were submitted, first of all, there's no case that our research has disclosed where an American citizen working in the United States, living in the United States, was awarded severance under Canadian law. But aside from that, if you resign, you don't get Canadian-style severance. Mr. Comrie resigned. If you allege constructive dismissal, as he did, Canadian law requires that you mitigate, which interestingly requires that you remain in your position. You're not free to leave and then claim the benefit unless your employer makes it so demeaning and demoralizing and unconscionable that any reasonable person would leave. So under any set of analysis, the claim doesn't survive. We would request, unless there are additional questions, that the court affirm Judge Dara in all respects. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Mollica?
Yes, sir. Mr. Miyasi made an important misstatement of the record with respect to the summary plan description. Mr. Miyasi told you that there was nothing before the benefit committee that told them that he received the SPD and was relying on it to interpret the SERP. In fact, and you'll see this cited at pages 5 and 6 of our reply brief, in the administrative record, when he appealed the denial of the determination, in his letter to the benefit committee, Mr. Comrie wrote, "I asked Ray Rary to give me the provisions of IFSCO's 401k plan so I could understand the definition of compensation referred to in my pension, the U.S. SERP. He told me to speak to Arla Morrow or Katie Newberry." So the benefit committee did that, have that in front of them. Second, Mr. Miyasi told your honors that the benefit committee interpreted the 401k plan instrument, the adoption agreement, because he says that the SERP refers to that document. It does not. It refers to the 401k plan, and it says that compensation is as defined under the plan. The question that we've presented by this appeal is the benefit committee should have considered the adoption agreement, the prototype agreement, and the summary plan description, all of which are part of the 401k plan, and as Judge Rovner points out, stand on equal footing. And the benefit committee simply adopted one version of the adoption agreement, the one that they never gave to Mr. Comrie, and used that as their basis. That was error. It's legal error, and even under a discretionary, abuse of discretion, or arbitrary and capricious standard, that's reversible because it violates the plain terms of the plan. Third, now we're going to move on to counts 2 and 3, the promise. There were 3 promises, Your Honor, and Mr. Miyasi addresses a couple of them, but doesn't address the promise that Mr. Comrie relied on in 1999 when he came to the United States, that he would not suffer a reduction, material reduction, in his Canadian-style benefits. And under Illinois law, the only authority there is, the Blem case, the Doe case, and to some extent the Armstrong case, says that a claim for a benefit accrues under Illinois law when you become eligible to claim it. And Mr. Comrie only became eligible to claim the pension benefit upon turning in his letter in August of 2007.
Are these claims preempted or aren't
they preempted? They are not preempted, Your Honor. They arise under Canadian law.
Well, I know you start with Illinois law. That's preempted.
Right. If the contract had an Illinois choice of law clause, I guess I would sit down.
That means federal law applies, I believe.
No, Your Honor.
Federal law applies. Oral promises are not acceptable to vary the terms of an ERISA plan, right?
We're not varying the terms of a plan at all, Your Honor. They are guaranteeing that whatever happened to him after he left in 1999, he would not get smaller benefits. The problem, Your Honor, and Judge Dara correctly decided that Canada had a much greater interest in enforcing that promise than Illinois did. And it is not preempted. It is not state law. 401, Section 514.
Start with state law to get there.
The only state law that we have to brush over is the choice of law question. And, Your Honor, under Dubuano and under the District of Columbia cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, these choice of law questions are ones of general applicability, which are not preempted under Section 514. And that's also in our reply brief, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.